Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. John Paulson made $15 billion in 2007 betting against the American housing market, the biggest trading payoff in history, far bigger than investor George Soros' billion-dollar killing on the British pound. It vaulted Paulson, a low-profile hedge fund manager, straight to the top of America's aggressive finance circles, while millions of Americans struggled with the fallout. This hour, On Point, we'll get inside the biggest trade in history. You can join the conversation. How does $15 billion sound on one giant trade against the American housing market, the bubble? What do you hear in the story of John Paulson? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Gregory Zuckerman. He covers hedge funds and investing for the Wall Street Journal, where he writes the Herd on the Street column. His new book is The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. John Hellyer, who wrote Barbarians at the Gate, says Zuckerman takes us to Wall Street's heart of darkness in the book. Gregory Zuckerman, thanks very much for being here.
Great to be here.
$15 billion in 1 year betting against what? Betting against the housing bubble, when everybody else was more or less still riding it.
Exactly. And he kind of followed it up with a bet against financial firms to make another $5 billion in 2008, making this, as you say, the greatest trade in financial history.
So we're talking about $20 billion in a couple of years.
Yes.
And he did it by betting that the housing bubble would blow up, that the housing market would essentially collapse.
Yeah, basically, I write about John Paulson and a few others who are the winners in this financial fiasco over the past few years. They're a little bit, I envision them sort of like Noah in the biblical story. They built their ark. People call them fools. They thought some sort of collapse and calamity was coming, and it turns out they were right, and the experts were wrong.
But when John Hellyer talks about this book, Illuminating Wall Street's Heart of Darkness, he's not talking about the $20 billion they made or the bet they made against the housing market. He's talking about the fact that most of Wall Street was riding along on this bubble, I guess, happy to do it in a way with subprime lending and all the rest, happy to pump it up.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing if you think about it. The people that got hurt the most over the past few years were the people creating some of this product. It's almost like a butcher who's got some noxious meat and brings it home to their own kids and gets them sick. It's one of the more confounding elements of the collapse. And yeah, John Paulson and some of the others were outsiders. They weren't mortgage experts. They weren't housing experts. They weren't even short sellers like some of the other pros. They just thought that what was going on was all going to collapse, and this something was wrong at the core of our financial system.
A lot of people would have been satisfied where John Paulson was at the beginning of your story. I mean, he already sat on, what, a sort of $100 million fortune. He wasn't a superstar in the hedge fund world, his realm, but he was doing all right.
It's a fascinating thing. Only on Wall Street can you be worth $100 million and still be a singles hitter, a run-of-the-mill, and that's what he was. He had a fine career. He was specializing in merger investing, which is among the safest types of investing, and yet he never had his big trade. He never had his acclaim, and this was his potential way to do that.
You know, I felt like such a tiny little speck in the midst of great big finance webs as I read this, and I would think others would too. The way whole gigantic markets can be ridden and maybe even manipulated by traders on Wall Street. But I want to just set aside all the judgment for a minute just to understand how this works, because John Paulson's still at it and he's not alone. This is the kind of hedge fund work that goes on day in and day out, year in and year out, all around us, teeny tiny players or parts of this system. I mean, just explain to us what was the opportunity that he spotted? How did he spot it? And how did he begin to go about raking in $15 billion in a single trading year on it?
Sure. John Paulson grew up middle class in Queens, New York, and Went to some good schools, did pretty well there, and came to Wall Street and was an investment banker and started his hedge fund and didn't do especially well. Took him a while to kind of get a name on the street. And by 2005 or so, he had these kind of vague worries about housing, and he didn't really know how to express them. And he had a right-hand man named Paolo Pellegrini, who had a little experience in something called credit default swaps, which sounds sort of fancy and complicated, but it basically means just insurance on mortgages and any other kind of debt. And together they figured out that this stuff was really selling at dirt cheap levels. So if they bought a lot of it, if they backed up the truck is what they did, and bought a lot of it, they could really potentially have this huge home run. And the fascinating thing is all the experts weren't buying this insurance. And again, it was trading at such cheap levels that basically it was costing John Paulson and his firm about 7% a year. So that was the downside, about 7% a year. And the upside was hundreds of percentage points of gains. And yet no one was doing it. That's one of the more fascinating things that I came across in my research. Why was it John Paulson? It wasn't a Soros or a Bill Gross, who's the bond king on Wall Street, or Soros, or a Buffett. It wasn't any of those experts. And yet it was a guy, John Paulson, who never did any mortgage or housing investing in his whole lifetime.
But it was dirt cheap because they weren't taking on board just how dangerous this huge asset bubble, the housing bubble, really was. If that was fully acknowledged, this insurance should have cost a lot more, I guess.
Yes, it was dirt cheap because very few people thought that housing would collapse. And John Paulson had a difficult time convincing people. When he started his fund, he wanted backers, he wanted investors. The only way to do a real home run on Wall Street is to get a lot of investors and then to put a lot of money on a trade. And he went up and down the street. He went to Harvard University. He went to some of the smartest investors, and they all had really good explanations for why they didn't invest. Well, the government's going to step in and help housing, or the Fed could always cut interest rates. And John Paulson and a few of the others I track in their chase to make money from this trade thought they were wrong.
So essentially, they invested, what, $100+ million in this credit default swaps that would become very valuable if in the right time frame the whole housing market went south, and that happened for him.
Right. Basically, they started off with about $140 million or so, and over time raised more money. People started getting more nervous throughout 2006, and they every piece of insurance on risky mortgage product they could buy, they kept on buying. So they eventually spent more than $1 billion, actually, on the insurance, and it made them $20 billion over 2 years.
That is a staggering sum, but it's even a little more, it's a lot more complicated than that. Among the things that he did was he went out and had investment banks sort of whip up things that he could buy. No, they knew that he was going to bet against the very credit vehicles that he asked them to create.
Yes, there's a controversial issue that's brought up in the book, and that is at one point John Paulson couldn't get enough of this insurance. He wanted to buy more and more and more. This was his chance. This was a chance for fame and obviously for fortune, and maybe his one chance left. He's about 50 years old, and on Wall Street, you don't have a long career. So he was looking for any kind of opportunity, and he went to investment banks such as Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns and some others and said, if you create some toxic product, then I can buy insurance on it. And he is not someone who thinks about the moral issues involved in something like that, such as, hey, well, when you create more toxic products, someone's going to eventually potentially face some losses from it. His job, the way he looked at it, was his clients are pension funds and endowments and charities and wealthy people. And he said, if I can make the money, that's my complete job. There are others in my book that I talk about that I track who had some moral qualms about this trade. But basically, John Paulson, yes, he asked and they created some toxic product. To be sure, in the scheme of things, was a very small percentage of all the toxic things we read about.
Now, name some banks that created toxic product for him and the one bank that declined, more or less on ethical grounds.
Yeah, Deutsche Bank created the product, as did Goldman Sachs. Bear Stearns, of all people, said something about this smells funny. And I think the bigger issue was that they went and they, in turn, sold it to their clients. Not as much that John Paulson was shorting it, but, hey, here's some toxic product that I'm creating potentially for John Paulson, and then we're going to go and create it to other investors. And the flip side is these weren't sold to mom and pops. These were sold to sophisticated individuals, and they should have known better.
They were made in a way to die. They were made in a way to fail. so that John Paulson, if they would win.
You know, in hindsight, that's a way to look at it. But at the time, people on Wall Street thought John Paulson was a fool and he was wasting his time. And they were thrilled to create product that he was going to bet against because they thought he was going to be wrong. Housing was not going to collapse. And he had to really tackle some of those criticisms. And there were all kinds of experts that came to his firm and they told him he was wrong.
But it did collapse. Housing did collapse. You might say he helped it collapse. We'll talk about that. If it hadn't collapsed in the window he was betting on, he could have lost big time. Instead, what happened beginning when? When did the wave of cash begin to roll in?
So he put on the trade in 05, but mostly in 2006. And by early 2007, things were really looking bad. Things were collapsing. In February 2007, John Paulson and his firm made 66% in a single month. And to give you some context, he had never made more than a few percentage points in a single month. His investors called up and they were actually quite concerned. They get these statements that say they were up 66% in a month. And they thought it was a typo. They thought it should have been 6.6%. And some were actually nervous and told them to take the trade off. And I would argue at that point, it became riskier for him because he would have been known as the man who bet against housing, made billions, and then lost it all. And his right-hand man, Paolo Pellegrini, who didn't have that much money in the bank, this was sort of a last stop for him at Paulson & Company. He had spent a career from job to job on Wall Street, a bright guy who never really made it. He encouraged Paulson to take some profits and we should do some selling. And John Paulson had conviction that not only was the housing market in trouble, but so was the financial system. So he ignored everyone and he kept on holding on and buying more of this protection.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the story of a Wall Street killing, a hedge fund investor who bet everything that the U.S. housing market would collapse and won the biggest payoff in trading history, $15 billion, in a single year. Gregory Zuckerman is with us. He's written the book that tells the story of the great trade of John Paulson. It's called The Greatest Trade Ever. I've got just a little bit of tape. We invited John Paulson on this hour. He declined. He's betting now on gold, and we'll talk about that. But in November 2008, he testified before the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee on a hedge fund regulation. And here he's explaining the strategy that reaped him billions.
To protect our investors against the risk in the financial markets, we purchased protection through credit default swaps on debt securities we thought would decline in value. As credit spreads widened and the value of these securities fell, we realized substantial gains for our investors.
Yes, substantial. $15 billion in a single year, $20 billion before it was all over. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Gregory Zuckerman is here from New York. And Gregory, what was it that John Paulson and Paolo Pellegrini saw in the trend lines of American home prices that got their attention, that gave them the confidence to make this hair-raising bet?
They basically went through the numbers and were diligent about it and spent a lot of time going through the numbers, and they basically put it on a trend line, as you said, and they saw right in front of their eyes that the housing market had never before climbed so fast and couldn't go on that way. And you could say to yourself, it's sort of a simple observation made by many others. And I would agree. They then took the next step of figuring out how is the best way to bet against the housing market. And many didn't take that bet. And it's interesting why. You know, there's this sort of conventional wisdom that there are a lot of gamblers on Wall Street and especially in the hedge fund market. And there clearly are some. But I would argue maybe there aren't enough who are making unconventional kind of gutsy trades. Instead, people pile on. And that's why we're seeing, I would argue, why we're seeing so many of these financial bubbles over the past few years. If you just think about it, obviously housing, but if you go back at energy markets just a couple years ago, obviously the technology market and Asian currencies before that, these are historic bubbles. And I would argue it's because too many people are following each other on Wall Street, and there's too much big money that's swishing, going towards opportunities at the drop of a dime, and without thinking about them through and talking about, everyone talks about making an unconventional contrarian bet, but very few do. And this is what John Paulson and some others did.
So I'm trying to figure out how to look at this man. Maybe for starters, how you look at him. I mean, you live and and breathe the investment world, covering, you know, with your Heard on the Street column for the Wall Street Journal. So the guys that make the big money are the heroes of Wall Street. And you tell us that John Paulson is now, you know, cited by everybody. Everybody's paying big attention to him. He's up there with Warren Buffett and George Soros and Bernard Baruch and sort of legendary names like that. How do you look at this man? Is this a hero, a devil, someone, is there redeeming social value or just the billions he put in his pocket and the pockets of others?
See, Tom, I'm an old school journalist. I'm not from the MSNBC, Fox kind of world where I take positions. I try to let my readers form their own views. I would argue that he's neither a hero nor a villain. He's not somebody who's dedicated as much money to charity as maybe some would want, although lately he's starting to do that. And yet his clients are pension funds and charities and endowments. That's a good thing. He is part of our system. We've created this system. We've allowed the system where you can make lots and lots of money. I mean, the numbers are just cartoonish. They're just remarkable. We criticize Wall Street executives for making $30, $40 million a year. And again, John Paulson personally made $5 billion in 2007 and another $2 billion in 2008. I would argue that you need people like John Paulson who make these unconventional bets against bubbles. People like Jim Chanos is a short seller who spotted Enron early. So I would argue you need more of these kinds of people. But that said, you are because of you have more hedge fund managers and there's a lot of incentive for these people to make a lot of money. You get things like the Galleon insider investigation, which I've been working on, and you get some of the bad stuff as well.
I'm still looking for a bottom line there. I mean, I would argue that a journalist like you, Gregory, who doesn't have a sense of the social impact of this activity, is just caught up in the game. I mean, do you see the economy is supposed to work, right, for the people who live in it ultimately?
I would argue, I think there are I'm sorry to interject. Yeah. I do think there are too many people out there making financial bets. I think too many of our best and brightest have gone into Wall Street over the past few decades. It's remarkable. I mean, we could have half as many traders and investors, and still the markets would be quite efficient and competitive. So clearly, something's gone wrong in this country, and that's what we incentivize and encourage our children to go into that line of work. That said, you need, you know, financial markets for there to be a vibrant economy, and people who burst bubbles, who tackle bubbles mm-hmm. and try to burst them, I think do have some social benefit.
So if John Paulson hadn't done this, hadn't helped pop the bubble, it might have gotten even bigger with worse ramifications?
You know, it's an interesting theory, and I kick it around. It's hard to prove it. I talk to my brother, who's an academic, about it a lot. And you can really make that argument that it took until 2005 and clearly in 2006, there were very few good ways to bet against housing. And one could say, I don't think it's a coincidence that the housing market actually finally collapsed in 2006 and for sure 2007, right after these bets were introduced. Because until then, only the bulls were able to make the bets. Everybody else sort of sat on their hands, and the marginal investor was a buyer. So I think you need people to make these bets against bubbles. That said, again, there's too much in the way of firepower and intelligence going into hedge funds and Wall Street, and I'm not sure everyone needs to be doing these kinds of things, but too many people are inflating bubbles and doing the same trades and reading the same information. I mean, I talk to investors all day long, and so often they've got the same things to say. They're reading the same things. They watch the same business programs on television, and that's why we get these bubbles, and I would argue that we're going to get more of them. And you look around the world even right now, Brazil is up 100%, China, some even real estate markets in Asia are booming again. It's a little worrisome.
John Paulson was a contrarian, and he came out $20 billion ahead, betting against the American housing market. Let's get some listeners in here from Los Angeles, California. Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Greg Zuckerman.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Greg. I really like the show. My issue with the credit default swaps, and I guess you mentioned it before, but how you could just make these bets. You don't have to own. You don't actually have to own that debt. And, you know, I understand that that's possibly helped regulate things in a bubble environment. But also it created, I thought, the leverage that we saw that really, you know, caused the collapse. And wondering if they're going to regulate anything in that matter.
I completely agree with you, and that's why AIG had all its problems. There were too many of these CDS contracts, which are basically just insurance products that anyone could buy. They were creating many more of these contracts, these insurance contracts, than the underlying debt. So on paper, it makes sense. Okay, you've got this debt and somebody wants some insurance, so you create these insurance products. But at some point, they were creating too many, many more of these insurance products than the underlying debt. And that's what got us into all these problems. I completely agree. And as a result, there's a lot of talk about more transparency in the CDS market, and there's very little action. The government hasn't done much. I mean, if you think about it, Tim Geithner, he is a product of the system and the markets, and you don't get guys like John Paulson running things in government, actually. You get people who are from the system and are products of the system. So I do worry about that, but I agree with the caller that there should be the CDS market should be reined in. There should be more transparency there.
Or the rest of us maybe get mowed like the lawn. Barry in Northampton, Massachusetts. Barry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This $20 billion came from somewhere. Where would this money be if John Paulson hadn't made these bets and made this money?
Gregory?
That's a good question. People on the other side included John Paulson went through brokers, and he himself was never sure who was on the other side. So I could never be either. But logically, AIG was part of that, and lots of investment banks. I can tell you for sure that $4 billion of the $20 billion came from Deutsche Bank. They're the ones who created this toxic product, some of the toxic product that at John Paulson's behest, and went and sold it to their investors, but they couldn't sell all of it, and they ended up keeping too much of it on their own books. So it wasn't sort of an individual investor or any kind of anybody you necessarily would think, but it was the actual party, Deutsche Bank, the bank that was creating this product. Again, it goes back to my analogy with the butcher. It's remarkable to me that they believed in this stuff and they kept it on their books.
Let's go to Robert in Littleton, Massachusetts, and we're not losing track of your question about where the money would have been otherwise. But Robert, first to you.
Yes, well, I guess a lot of my questions have been answered the last two callers, but well, it comes down to how much of this money came from the American federal government bailing out AIG or other holders of credit default swaps?
It's indirect. It's hard to make that argument. John Paulson was helped by the fact that AIG was bolstered, was saved by the government, but we're talking about helped in a few billion of his $20 billion. And had the government let AIG go under, he would have lost some bets, but he would have made others because he was betting against, he was buying insurance on almost every brokerage firm, and they would have had real difficulty had AIG gone under, especially Goldman Sachs. So his other bets would have done well.
But if AIG was on the other side of this bet, in other words, if they were the loser as he was the winner, that does seem to wend its way back to the public treasury here with the bailout.
To the extent that AIG was on the other side of these trades, yes. Again, AIG was selling insurance, and John Paulson was buying insurance on the other side of these things. And you could argue that AIG shouldn't have sold so many or John Paulson shouldn't have bought so many. You can clearly, as the first caller makes the point, and I think it's a good point, that CDS was out of control. John Paulson was playing by the rules of the system.
And if that $20 billion hadn't not ended up in his pocket, his hedge fund's coffers, where would it be? Just out there in the great, you know...
Banks would have been sitting on more money. Some investors, some hedge funds would have had more money. A number of investors. I mean, my book is about how he and a few other investors went up against the conventional wisdom on Wall Street. Goldman Sachs, early on, went to him and said, John, you are wrong. Whatever you're buying, we're going to sell. And they took a stance opposed from him. And they early on, they lost money. They eventually realized that Paulson was right, and they turned gears and started buying the same insurance protection that John Paulson was betting on. So, again, the losers included AIG, but they also included some sophisticated investors like hedge funds.
Anne in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Well, I kind of agree with some of the last callers. I mean, in the end, a big portion of this $20 billion, you know, comes from the American taxpayers because we bailed out a lot of these companies that had to pay up. I mean, to me, this is just taking advantage and is on the edge of thievery. It's like finding a wallet full of money and not trying to find the owner when you know somebody lost that. I think this money, you know, ought to go back to the American taxpayers.
And what about, I mean, Americans were in on this in another way, which is lots of people's home values were going up dramatically in the early parts of this decade, maybe too dramatically. You know, maybe there was, this was funny money in the first place that, you know, people, now everybody's underwater, or an awful lot of folks, but maybe Americans were, you know, living their own kind of unrealistic dream here in the housing values.
Well, I suppose there's always a few people that made out like bandits. You know, personally, in our situation, we live in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. I mean, my husband bought a condo back in the mid-'80s, and he lost 20% of that condo value back then when this local market tanked. So, you know, sometimes you win with these investments of a house, sometimes you lose. If you own the property for a long time, you'll probably come out ahead, but I don't know.
It's going to take a long time after this crash. But, Ann, thanks for your call. Greg Zuckerman, you remind us that, what is it, 1 in 10 Americans by the middle of this year were delinquent or in foreclosure on their mortgages, and housing prices way, way, way down. That loss is what paved the way for John Paulson's gain.
See, the way I would look at it, and now, Tom, you're pushing me from objective journalist to take a stand here. I would argue that too many people in this country, too many firms, too many investors got caught up in a craze. And John Paulson saw this, and he was a small investor at the time, and he said, wait a second, it's inappropriate for subprime mortgage lenders to be giving these kinds of mortgages to their clients, and they're cheating them, and it's not right. And he said, this is not going to last, and I've got to figure out a way. I wouldn't say protect his investors, but make money for my investors. That's my job. I've got pension funds as clients. I've got endowments that are my clients, and I'm charged with making them money. And this is craziness, what's going on out there. And I'm going to tell some people about it, but no one's listening to me. Everyone thinks I'm a fool. So I got to figure out the best way to make money from this. And yeah, you could argue that, I don't know, he made too much and he should give more back. But I would personally argue that we should be scolding those in government and those in private industry who made mistakes along the way leading up to this craze that led to so many problems in this country.
Let's hear from Jeff in Charlottesville, Virginia. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to sort of parlay the comments of the other callers into a sort of a radical statement about the character of the system. It's obviously pretty tricked out to the kind of a thing that seems to concentrate wealth. It's sort of privatizing the winnings and socializing the losses.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to go with that for a couple sentences?
Sure. Greg, how about it?
Yeah, listen, I think it's horrible that these banks became so big, they became too big to fail, and the government had to step in for the sake of all of us, I believe. Had we not, I don't know if this country, the way we're set up nowadays, could have handled a much deeper recession. And they decided, Geithner, et cetera, Bernanke, that we don't want to have to test that. So we're going to step in here and we're going to save the banks. And to that extent, you could argue now that they're very profitable, the banks, you could argue that maybe they shouldn't have. I don't know.
John Paulson isn't a sort of oracle now. People are really listening to him. On what front? What's he talking about these days?
It's fascinating. He is the new Buffett. Warren Buffett recently came out, and it turns out that he's buying Walmart shares, and Walmart shares didn't do anything on the news. John Paulson, just a hint that John Paulson likes an investment, sends the stock or the bond skyrocketing. And you could argue that it's inappropriate. I mean, we're going too far with this thing. And he had a lot of good fortune, too. He put on his trades in 2006, right before housing started flattening out and then collapsing. So he was a very smart guy, and he had a lot of guts. And I think there's a lot to be learned from him and how he approached markets. And even as a person who, at around 50 years old, had a second leg in his career, and it gives us all sort of encouragement. But there's a flip side too there. So I think it's all, you know, important to remember all that kind of those themes.
We'll look at what he's pointing to next for the next big killing. You remind us of his, what, $41 million house on Long Island. Is he a happy guy?
He seems to be. It's hard to figure out. He's not necessarily a guy you want to have a beer with. He's a fascinating character. And frankly, I wrote about five or six interesting, complex, gray characters. And I'm sort of drawn to those as a writer. And that's also why I'm not really taking a stand necessarily. It's hard to say whether these guys are good guys or bad guys. So is he happy? He's got a beautiful couple daughters and a happy family life. I don't know if listeners would like me to say he's not happy. It's hard to say. He's just an interesting, complex individual.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the story of a Wall Street killing a hedge fund investor, John Paulson, who bet everything that the U.S. housing market would collapse and won the biggest payoff in trading history, $15 billion in a single year. Gregory Zuckerman is with us from New York. His new book is The Greatest Trade Ever. It tells the story of exactly that, the American housing bubble going poof, and John Paulson and his hedge fund making a fortune, $15 billion, then $20 billion. Gregory, people are asking if John Paulson is related to Hank Paulson. We should clear that up.
No relation whatsoever.
Okay. And he's still totally in business, and this time his bet is on gold. He's saying what, gold is going to go even higher?
Yeah, I would argue this is even a riskier bet for him because gold not that long ago was $400 or $500 an ounce, and now it hit $1,200 an ounce today. And he's only starting his investing. He already has a lot. He's among the biggest gold investors in the world. He owns more than some countries right now because he has about 15% or so of his $30 billion in assets in gold. And his argument is that, and he's starting a new fund to put billions more into gold. And his argument is that governments around the world, including ours, threw too much money at problems over the last year or so. And we've hurt our currency, or it's going to hurt our currency. The dollar is going to keep falling, as we're seeing. And the only way to protect yourself is to buy gold.
So he's betting against the U.S. dollar and betting on inflation.
Not necessarily inflation, although there could be inflation. It could just be that the dollar keeps getting weaker and weaker, and we have seen that. And I would argue that it's a riskier bet because it's something of conventional wisdom right now on Wall Street to buy gold and to see gold as an alternative to all the currencies for sure. And you could even argue that he's doing the opposite of his housing bet, which was sort of radical and unconventional, and now he's going with the flow, which is buying gold. And he's got this fascinating way of simplifying really complex issues. And early in his career, people thought he was a little too simple and they didn't give him his money. But he actually is sort of like the character in Beautiful Mind, where he can actually take real complex issues, and he's a smart guy, very smart guy, and he boils them down really nicely. And his argument is that the supply of money has soared, and that's going to hurt the price, the value of money, and therefore I got to own gold. And gold is sort of a greater fool kind of investment. You don't really like gold. You know, maybe you like to use it for a few things, but you like it because
anything.
The next guy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't produce anything, exactly. There's no real intrinsic value, as they say on Wall Street, but you like it because the next guy kind of likes it, and the third guy likes it, so you own it. So it's an interesting trade.
So is it a doomsday scenario, his current bet? If gold, he imagines gold will go very much higher. Does that mean everything else has to kind of go to hell in a handbasket?
Not everything, but currencies, yeah. He thinks that the U.S. dollar and all kind of leading currencies, not necessarily the Chinese currency or the yen, but all our fellow countries who have thrown all these money, we've spent, as we all know, the billions and trillions to try to solve these problems and throw money at problems and this program and that program. Well, we've had to print lots of dollars for that, and therefore it's going to hurt the currency, he would argue, as it already has. It's going to hurt it even more. And the only alternative to the dollar and to currencies, historically, he would argue, is gold. And you could say, well, okay, maybe there'll be something else, maybe there are other ways to hedge yourself. And there are real criticisms of him. And this is, in that way, it is actually kind of a radical bet because people say he's not a gold guy. Just like they said with housing, what does he know about gold? And a year ago, he really didn't know a thing about gold, frankly. He never did any gold investing. And yet now he's got more gold than some countries.
Pedro's calling from Seekonk, Massachusetts. Pedro, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is really about some of the callers. And I think there's a real misplaced anger at this guy, that this guy, in some manner of speaking, is a hero, that he sniffed out that what we've done in D.C. and Wall Street, they have conspired in D.C. and Wall Street to put together a system that is corrupt, and this guy noticed it. And it's not this is not an anti-capitalist rant. This is a recognition that both Democrats and Republicans and Wall Street put together a system that could not work, and this guy sniffed it out. And I think that there's a credit that we have to give to this guy, not because he's a billionaire, not because he has all this money, but because he recognized that the system itself, the particulars of the laws and everything like that, that's why it worked for him, because he recognized we got a screwed up system.
Yeah, Pedro, but what about the fact that he went out and tried to make a little bit more of that screwed up system, saying, you know, create toxic product for me so I can bet against it, please?
Well, Well, because it was doable in the system. You could create those toxic products, and Deutsche Bank is more than willing to oblige.
Yeah.
So he was taking advantage of what was set up, and this is D.C. and Wall Street in bed together. And I want to compliment the guy. I think it's unfortunate because I do think the money he has comes from us, ultimately, the taxpayers. But there's a way in which he had to do this. If he didn't, the emperor had no clothes anyway.
Yeah, Greg, what do you say? He sniffed out the punky stuff, the rot in the system, and made a huge killing on it. What about that interpretation?
I tend to agree. I mean, my book is about the winners in this mess, the people who actually weren't part of Wall Street, who sniffed this out and figured things out and figured out how to bet against it. There's a doctor turned investor in Northern California. There's a Playboy guy in Southern California, a surfer, and another guy in California. Mm-hmm. And these guys, including John Paulson, realized something was a mess in the system, and they were worried, and people thought they were fools, and they realize they've got clients and they've got their own money and they're going to play by the system. You could argue that they shouldn't have been able to bet so much, I suppose, but I would argue that the betting against the system often sends a message, and that message is to be worried. And you need people to send those messages. You need these gutsy, unconventional short seller types, people that I know don't get good press, but I think they play an important role.
But what is the message, in your estimation, about what needs to happen here? One message was the housing market was overpriced, and that clearly was borne out. But there's also a system here and a structure that allowed all kinds of gaming to go on. Is the John Paulson story a story that would speak for more or different regulation taking away some of these exotic vehicles that made this kind of bet on both sides possible?
Yes. It would argue that rating agencies, the guys that put these A ratings on all this toxic debt, should be scrutinized. And there's a little bit of that going on right now, but not much. That's why a lot of investors got caught up in this. That's why a lot of banks felt comfortable. It would argue that banks need to be more careful about what they get involved in. And I was fascinated by how hard it was for people within banks to bet against housing. And there's a gentleman I track, a trader named Greg Littman, who told his bosses that at Deutsche Bank that we got problems here in this country, and I don't know why we're doing this. And people kind of laughed at him and thought he was cute and allowed him to make a few of these bets, but not too many at first. And he had to fight the system. And I don't know, I think that it says something about the system we've got where people focus on what the other investor is doing, what the other executive is doing, much more so on whether it's right. And they're competing with each other and they get in these bubbles every few years. And my worry is that we've got another one around the bend and there aren't enough people thinking outside the box and worried about the system. And that's what John Paulson was.
But surely there's a better way of bleeding off bubbles than, you know, $20 billion into the handful of folks who invest in a single hedge fund, traders fund. I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, I mean, people like George Soros have argued that regulators need to step in when there are bubbles. But Alan Greenspan, you know, made some mistakes, but he did make the important point that it's very hard for, if it's hard for a sophisticated investor on Wall Street who spends his life focused on these markets to figure out when there's a bubble or not and when to bet against it, it's that much harder for someone in Congress or a regulator or even someone in the Federal Reserve. It's hard to figure these things out. I think you've got to allow people to bet against them and to send a message that these are the people that find these things out first. But I think the first caller made a really good point that they've got to be fewer of these vehicles, fewer of these credit default swaps. They've got to be on an exchange. There's got to be more transparency. So people like AIG can't sell all this insurance all day long and then say, whoops, well, we need some help from the government.
Got comments from the web here from Ben. He says, I'm struck by the way he treats the story as a game with no reflection on the fact that the game basically being played destroyed the American economy. So this is a story of Wall Street gambling with no benefit to the economy as a whole. There's a perspective. Here's another from Nathan saying, trying to blame John Paulson for the poor business practices of others, especially the banks, is foolish. He was not able to foresee the bailouts. He was not intending to harm the economy. By all evidence, he was merely doing his job within the system as he knew it. Yeah, big time. Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
My observation is simply this, that I think it's very difficult to vilify this individual. I think it's easy to do because of the amount of money that he made. But on the same token, we've lived through in the last decade a very unrealistic and very unsustainable housing bubble, to a point where it got so ridiculous in certain markets, people were literally flipping houses as fast as they could buy them, and assessing mm-hmm. them, somebody else would buy them from and make huge profits. And we as individuals were pulling equity out of these houses as fast as we could pull it out, as this growth was just going stratospheric on us. And you look around, and people are driving Volvos they have no business driving, and Jaguars and second homes and all these luxury goods that we purchased out of an unsustainable and unrealistic increase in values of properties, the likes of which our parents never saw, our grandparents never saw in their entire lifetimes. So aren't we just as guilty? Only, unfortunately, we didn't make billions, but we certainly spent tens and tens of thousands on an individual basis.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody was in on it in a way there, and that got harvested by John Paulson in a very painful way for a lot of people. But, Steve, let us hold that and go to Christine in Columbia, South Carolina. Christine, you're on the air.
Thank you. First of all, fantastic show. I really appreciate this. And I agree with the last two callers wholeheartedly. This financial system that we're talking about is a gaming system. It is a gamble that you place a bet, basically. And, you know, earlier callers were upset that it felt like a cost to taxpayers, and it is. But the cost to taxpayers is because our government, representing us, chose to bail out the losers. You know, it's kind of like going to Las Vegas and choosing to bail out the people who lost at the gaming tables. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's a horrible system. I don't mean that at all. I think it affords a lot of opportunity to people who come up with new ideas and grow businesses. But at the same time, to foolishly think that this is a fail-safe way to get a Volvo and a second house, you know, I think it was us pulling the wool over our own eyes, and Paulson showed us all that. So
go in eyes wide open, you say, Christina, and we've got it. And thank you. And let me get one more right here from Fort Myers, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. My point quickly is that there was a certain element of luck involved with this greatest trade ever. You know, there was a time element, and when
yes,
you're
indeed.
Investing, you might know exactly what's going to happen, but you never really know when.
Mm-hmm.
So, whether the guy's a genius or not is one question, but certainly he's very lucky to have hit within the time frame that he gambled on.
No kidding, and not everybody did. Thank you, David. Greg Zuckerman, there were others who were sniffing around here who just missed the window of opportunity. The time factor is crucial here.
It's fascinating, and I sort of studied big trades, and it's a hobby of mine. I love to see what you can learn from them. And, yeah, there were many people who were experts, housing-type people, who were a little bit too early, and they couldn't hold on. And there's one I track in my book who was ahead of Paulson, and he put on his trade, and he couldn't convince his investors that he was doing the right thing. He didn't have that much experience. He was a younger guy, and he didn't really have a lot of experience in housing. And his investors didn't believe him. Everyone got caught up in this craze. And, yeah, it's one thing to sense that there's a market, and there's a housing market that's going to have problems. Nothing to pull off the trade of the century. And a lot of his luck, as the last caller said, and a lot of his skill in believing in yourself and realizing that sometimes, even though you're not an expert necessarily, you still may have it right.
Couple more calls here. Mark, Fort Myers, Florida. You're on the air, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Your guests and the previous callers are right on point. In all this horror that has been the last few years of the housing market, here's the first sign of the market actually taking care of itself. The market got into this mess because simple economics were ignored all the way. And finally, one small sector thought clearly and began to sort of a correction on its own. And to say anything negative about these participants is really off point. I mean, this is what's supposed to happen. That's what's supposed to happen. We hear so much talk about how the market needs to take care of itself with health care and so many other sectors of the economy. And here's a sector of it actually doing the right thing. Now we're trying to lay blame for people just playing by the rules. You can't do that. That's what's actually supposed to happen. All the interference and unfair situations that were going on is what allowed it to happen. Finally, it does take care of itself, and we want to point fingers. You can't point fingers at those people. Point fingers at people who wrote these mortgages.
Well, it's all part of a system, though, and you might want to look at the rules to see how it got blown up just so big. And one more. Thank you, Mark. Candy in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Candy, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you see, Candy?
Well, I just wanted to say, bull, everybody knew that there was a housing bubble. Everybody knew. We living in Southern California in 2001 knew there was a housing bubble. The reason why it went on so long is because so many people were making so much money off of it, including Wall Street, including mortgage lenders, including everybody. and it just continued. You know, people were making money off of putting another mortgage on their house as they could afford things. Everybody was just flying in cash. It was just a question of when it was going to burst, and that was the big surprise, was that when it happened and that it happened so quickly.
And John Paulson called it and called it for an enormous profit. Candy, thanks for your call. And it's interesting what a range of responses. You get to this amazing story, Greg. You must hear that all the time, that range.
I do, and I hear people that criticize him and people that think he's a hero and everything in between. And to me, just the story is a fascinating. There's a lot of drama involved, and just an individual kind of late in his career figuring something out that all the experts told him he was wrong. And the chase, there are a few people that could pull it off. Some people couldn't pull it off. But what it does tell you about the system is we've got to do some reforming. But I would argue that you need more people like John Paulson who are kind of unconventional thinkers and get worried and don't get caught up in these crazes. And maybe if there were more of these guys, they wouldn't have been such a mess. But yeah, he did profit from the reverberations.
Boy, and when he did, it just rolled in. You write about a moment when he and his wife were on vacation. She went to an ATM expecting to see just, I don't know, what just a sort of not so much in the account, and there suddenly were $45 million, and that was the first of many tens of millions rolling in there.
That was actually his right-hand man, Paolo Pellegrini, who had never really made much his whole life, and he was a little bit superstitious, so he didn't tell his wife how well his firm is doing, and they go on vacation, and she just happens to check the ATM, and lo and behold, there's $45 million on the screen, and that was just a part of what he made that year. So yeah, it was a pretty good year for him.
And the billions and billions would follow. It is quite a tale. Gregory Zuckerman's book is The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Greg Zuckerman with The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for being with us this hour, Greg.
That was a lot of fun.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.